A new UN report says violence against women is reaching alarming levels.
Killings of women as a result of intimate partner violence, killings of women due to accusations of sorcery and witchcraft, killings of women and girls in the name of honor,
and a new focus on bullying. I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51%, The Women's Perspective. Violence takes many forms. There's physical violence, the kind that leaves bruises, the kind that can kill. And there's emotional violence, the kind that leaves bruises that aren't so easily seen, the kind that leads to substance abuse, emotional issues, and sometimes suicide. According to the United Nations, the killings of women, whether in the family, the community, or perpetrated by the state, are reaching alarming proportions around the world. That's the conclusion of Rashida Manju, the UN Special Rapporteur on Violence Against Women.
In a report presented to the Human Rights Council, Ms. Manju said many states are failing to guarantee a woman the right to a life free from violence.
States' responses to the killings of women can include tolerance, blaming victims, lack of access to justice and effective remedies, negligence, threats, corruption, and abuse by officials.
Other gender-related killings of women are occurring around the world.
These include killings of women as a result of intimate partner violence, killings of women due to accusations of sorcery and witchcraft, killings of women and girls in the name of honor, killings in the context of armed conflict, killings of indigenous women, killings as a result of sexual orientation and gender identity, and other forms of gender-related killings of women and girls, such as female infanticide.
According to the report, these forms of violence against women are culturally and socially embedded. They continue to be accepted and tolerated with impunity. Yet violence against women is condemned by many human rights bodies and instruments.
The killings of women constitutes a violation of, amongst others, the right to life, equality, dignity, non-discrimination, and the right not to be subjected to torture and other cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment or punishment.
Rashida Manju, the report gives examples of how some states have complied with their obligations to prevent violence against women. They include awareness-raising campaigns, training for police and the judiciary, and ensuring effective investigations, prosecutions, and sanctions.
That report comes to us courtesy UN Radio. But here's the question. Where do we find the roots of violence? We can't afford to be smug, to assume that this isn't an American problem. More than a quarter of American children experience parents physically fighting each other at some time in their lives. Early researchers into family violence often consider children to be invisible victims, but that view is changing. In this report for NPR's Youth Series, Valencia McMurray revisits an incident that happened in her family when she was six and has colored their lives for 14 years.
This is where my story begins. September 30th, 1997, at 652 Bush in St. Paul. I remember being inside this house. I remember my father standing right here on this porch, almost exactly where I'm standing, banging on the door. He just wanted to talk. She didn't want to listen to him, but I feel like she also didn't listen to us, because we told her, don't go outside, Mom. Please don't go outside, Mom.
I should have listened, but I figured it's going to be all right. The neighbors are all outside, and I just thought we were going to be safe. We wasn't.
His eyes were red. He was not him. He was someone else. There was no love in that man.
So we stood out there. We talked. And I told him that we couldn't get back together. And I think that's what made him mad. Because when I got up and turned my back to come in the house, that's when he stabbed me. And y'all was screaming and hollering.
I remember standing beside my sister inside. The youngest of my brothers was a few feet ahead of me, and then the second oldest of my siblings. He was trying to get through the screen door.
It just looked like he was hitting her, and then, like, I seen the streetlight glisten off the blades, and I'm standing in the doorway, and I was going to run through the back door and come around front, but I didn't want to do that and then miss something, and, you know, it'd be the last time he seen my mom alive.
I remember feeling the knife go into my neck. I remember giving up, but the picture of y'all, you, Jermaine, Vicky, and Roscoe, I remember that I saw y'all face. I kept seeing y'all face, and I couldn't give up because I kept saying, who gonna take care of y'all if I give up?
My mom's laying on a porch, bleeding to death, and, like, we lived a half a block away from the police station. And it's like she's trying to talk to 911, and they asking her questions. I left my little sisters and my brother with the neighbor, and I told the police officers that if you don't catch him before I do, I'm killing the b-. Well, I was walking around St. Paul for 3 days with a brick in my hand. And I was on my way back to his house, and my aunt called me and told me the police just picked him up at his house.
My dad spent 11 years in prison for trying to kill my mom. We had no contact with him. Meanwhile, our family's life was a blur of moving to different states. My mom was too paranoid to live in any one place. My siblings and I never talked about that night we almost lost our mom. It wasn't until I turned 18 that I dared to look back at what happened and think about how it affected me. Reading the police and court reports about that night in 1997, my sister and brothers and I are like background figures. Squad 332, Officer McPeak, was leaving East Team. I was approached by a hysterical young black male, later identified as Miller Jermaine Johnson. I then arrived on scene. There were several people on the porch. Children were standing near her crying hysterically. I asked that the children be taken away from the scene. I kneeled down. I asked my mom how she remembers us.
Nobody really never asked me, how the kids doing? And, you know, I think about that all the time. How did that affect y'all? Because when y'all was little and when it happened, I was trying to get y'all to go to therapy, to talk to someone. Wouldn't none of y'all go? Everybody was so angry, but nobody never actually told me how they felt about anything.
She's right. Until this interview, I hadn't talked to her about it. I avoided those emotions and thought this was in the past. Jeffrey Edelson says this isn't unusual at all. Edelson is an expert on how domestic violence affects kids. He directs the Minnesota Center Against Violence and Abuse at the University of Minnesota. He says it's a relatively new phenomenon to look at the long-term effects on kids.
It's only 25 to 30 years ago that we started to even mention the kids. It's only in the last 10 to 15 years that a lot of attention has been given to kids. So I think we're just at a starting point of responding to kids exposed to domestic violence.
Edelson says kids who grew up with parents physically fighting each other are 2 to 3 times more likely to use violence in their own relationships or become victims. That was certainly true in my case. As a kid, I got into a lot of fights. I was a bully. I remember this kid, David. All I remember is my first punch. Then I blacked out. That scared me. I'm just like my dad, I thought. I made a decision right then, at 12 years old, to stop fighting. And I haven't since. It doesn't seem like my siblings have done the same. My mom has also noticed that.
I guess the boys do got a lot of anger in them. And it upsets me that they do the things that they saw done to me. It really bothers me.
It really bothers me, too. I don't want my nieces and nephews to see things I've seen or to think violence is how you solve problems. Edelson says everybody has the ability to change. The will to change will come and go depending on pressures from outside.
It's learned. And it can be unlearned, and new ways can be learned. And that's the one thing that I'm really optimistic about.
Edelson says education and treatment can help offenders end their violent behavior. And the entire community needs to give clear and consistent messages that violence is not okay.
I've seen lots of people in the work that I did with Men Who Batter. A lot of men change and make big changes in their lives.
My dad walked back into my life on my 18th birthday. The courts had prevented him from contacting me until then. He called me up from his home in Wisconsin, and it was clear. The only thing that had changed was time. I was really mad because I couldn't understand how we thought we could start talking like nothing happened and like it wasn't a big deal. He didn't seem to think about how that one night had affected my whole life up to this point and is continually affecting the way I see men. His reply, well, that's the way I was raised. I was raised in violence. This made me angrier because if you understand how badly something has ripped holes in your heart and your life, why would you put that same burden on those you claim to love? Wouldn't you want to stop that cycle and keep your kids from that? I told him I lost him. I almost lost my mom. And if I could give up violence, he could too. I'm still waiting. For Minnesota Public Radio's youth radio series, I'm Valencia McMurray.
That report from Valencia McMurray comes to us from NPR's youth series. The recent Supreme Court decision upholding part of Arizona's controversial anti-immigration law is also seen by some as an attack on women and children, a form of bullying. In June, the Supreme Court unanimously upheld the section of Arizona's immigration law which requires state law enforcement officials to determine the immigration status of anyone they stop or arrest if there is a reason to suspect that he or she might be an illegal immigrant. We Belong Together, a coalition of the National Domestic Workers Alliance and the National Asian Pacific American Women's Forum, recently held a press conference in which Ellen Bravo of Family Values at Work explained why stricter immigration laws are a women's issue.
We Belong Together has been to Arizona, been to Alabama, and to Georgia, and talked to lots of individual women and families there. And here's what we've heard. We've heard about roadside checkpoints in Latino communities. We've heard from people who talk about Latino drivers that are repeatedly pulled over for minor or invented violations. We've heard of whole neighborhoods where residents are stopped almost every day by police who have targeted them. Let's talk about what racial profiling does. It makes it harder for women to care for their families. Literally, we're talking about whether you can take your kids to school, whether you can access medical care. It creates what we can only call a chill factor that prevents women from denouncing sexual assault or abuse in the workplace, from seeking protection against domestic violence. And where does it go? It leads to detentions and rips families apart. Immigrant women have been speaking out about this very courageously, and they are the leading voices for change. And unfortunately, they're the very voices that are either silenced or ignored in these policy debates. We think that the court's decision is grave concern to all women and families from every background. It's a huge setback for women's rights and for civil rights.
That's Ellen Bravo of Family Values at Work, discussing the perceived impact of June's Supreme Court unanimous decision upholding part of Arizona's controversial immigration law. Coming up, the impact of a video that shocked us all, from the internet to the Capitol. If you missed part of this show or want to hear it again, visit the 51% archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1200. Upstate New York grandmother Karen Klein became the face of bullying's victims after a video taken on the school bus she monitored was posted on YouTube. It showed four boys viciously taunting her, cursing at her, and reducing her to tears. Most of it can't be played on the air because of the language. The boys' families have received death threats. At least one of the fathers has apologized to Klein in person. A Toronto man who said he too was bullied as a child started an online fundraiser to pay for a vacation for Klein. He's raised almost $700,000 so far. In addition, another fund set up to thank him for starting the fund has raised an additional $6,500. Money he says he'll donate to anti-bullying organizations or will use to establish one himself. Congressman Mike Honda of California, who said he was bullied because he's Japanese American and whose family was moved to an internment camp during World War II, has announced a congressional anti-bullying caucus. Its goal, he says, is to work with stakeholders to end bullying once and for all. But nothing is more effective at making us aware of bullying than firsthand experience. Cristel Martinez came to America from the Dominican Republic with a dream to become a music producer. But the only music the 18-year-old senior hears in school is the sound of anger. This is her bullying soundtrack.
Track 1. I walk in and metal detectors beeping. School guards screaming, "Book bags and anything metal, take it off and throw it in a machine." Students pack the hall, competing to be the loudest. Duff! A locker slams. I try to ignore the screaming of, "Hey, yo, bitch." I feel lost as I walk to my class. Track 2. Second period. Students banging on the door because they're late. I see a young boy looking nervous. He speaks Spanish just like me. The teacher calls him out to read. He tells her, "Miss, no quiero." Someone from the back of the class says, "This hick. Go back to your country or speak English." The rest of the class laughs and I flinched. It felt like they were saying to my little sister. I say, "What's the joke? I sure didn't get it." Through all this, the teacher never said a word. She only says, "Be quiet." Track 3. I walk to lunch. I pass by some girls and I hear her whisper, "You saw how this girl beat up this one girl?" Then the school guard screaming, "Move out of the way!" as he hold the arm of the girl that was fighting. I enter the cafeteria, and I see kids buying and selling weed on top of the lunch tables. The adults, busy managing the lunch line, only yell, "Get off the tables!" Track 4, last period. I space out and think back to what school was like in the Dominican Republic. The warm, gentle brisa all throughout the year. Okay, I am not saying that it was perfect or that bullying wasn't a problem, but it's not like it is here. Far away from my mom and my sister, the soundtrack here makes me think, was moving here a good idea? Track 5. Ring! Last bell of the day, and I'm back to reality. Walking home, I worry about coming back to school tomorrow. Room! Car passing by. I take a deep breath, knowing that this is the last track of this CD. I hope that one day I can produce a better soundtrack. But until then, this one's on repeat.
And finally, Gilles Malkin profiles a woman who reminds us of the better angels of our nature.
Irena Sendler was born in 1910 in Otwock, near Warsaw, Poland. She was 19 in 1939 when Germany attacked, igniting World War II. Irena was not Jewish. She was a Catholic social worker and the daughter of a doctor who tended to many poor Jewish families. He had a simple credo that served Irena well. People can only be divided into good or bad. Their race, religion, nationality don't matter. She was working in the Department of Social Welfare at the time, bringing aid to many of the needy and sick that needed help in Warsaw. One of the ways in which she got help to Jews was by having them register with Christian names. When the Nazis closed off a portion of Warsaw in 1942 to trap and condemn thousands of Jews, the death rate within it soared. No food or medicine was allowed to be brought in. Irena smuggled in what she could, using an ID from the Epidemic Control Department. There's nothing more haunting than the faces of the children in the Warsaw Ghetto, as seen in documentary films taken at the time. The faces are etched with the ravages of hunger and sickness. The eyes are filled with an incomprehension that fills the innocent souls behind them. Irena joined the Żygota, an underground network of the Polish resistance with the object of helping Jews. And at the risk of being shot on the spot, she and about 20 other women began working to extricate Jewish children and place them in the homes of outside families who were willing to take them. Neither task was easy. You may think the hardest part of this was sneaking them out or finding homes for them. No, the hardest part was the families giving them up to give them a chance to survive, and Irena was haunted for the rest of her life with the sounds of their parting cries. Then she had to forge identifications and passes and provide new names for the children. She sent many, if not most, to convents, where the sisters would accept them, and to orphanages, where they would disappear into the existing population. The children were smuggled out in different ways, in the bottom compartment of a tool kit, in burlap potato sacks, under piles of junk, in coffins and body bags, in ambulances, and through a church that had a back door to the outside. She carefully noted the names of the children and the families with whom they were placed, and kept the list in jars she buried in her backyard. But it couldn't go on forever, and Irena was eventually betrayed by an associate under torture and arrested by the Gestapo. They took her to the Powiak prison, where they tortured her, breaking her legs and feet to get her to talk, but she never betrayed her associates or revealed the names or the whereabouts of the children. She survived the ordeal. Scheduled to be executed, a bribe was procured to save her life and to allow her escape from the prison. After the war, Irena found that she had the names of 2,500 children. She was far from satisfied with the results of her work, however. She said, "I could have done more, and this regret will follow me to my death." She worked hard then to reunite the children with their families, but most had disappeared as victims of the war. Irena Sendler's story was unearthed by a high school teacher in Kansas and written into a play by four students in 1999, titled Life in a Jar. It received much acclaim, and subsequently a movie was filmed on the story titled The Courageous Heart of Irena Sendler. Another, more in-depth film was made by Mary Skinner, titled Irena Sendler, In the Name of Their Mothers. In 2003, Irena Sendler was awarded the Order of the White Eagle, Poland's highest honor. She was decorated by many Jewish organizations and made an honorary citizen of Israel. The Yad Vashem Holocaust Memorial Center in Jerusalem bestowed upon her the title of Righteous Among the Nations in 1965. Sendler was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize in 2007. It went instead to Al Gore for his warning to the world about how badly we've polluted it. As for Irena, she said in a letter, "Every child saved with my help is the justification of my existence on this earth, and not a title to glory." Irena Sendler died with pneumonia in Warsaw in 2008 at the age of 98. Thank you for listening. For 51% and Women in History, I'm Gilles Malkin.
Gilles Malkin is a writer and musician. He lives in New York's Catskill Mountains. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. You can also find a regular column related to 51% at feminist.com. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.